Now we were looking last time at we had completed our examination of the progress of the evolutionary movement, and then we turned our attention to the similar movement in relation to the study of the Bible. And we called G the rise and spread of the Gross-Bellhausen theory. And under that, we noticed, number one, the background of literary criticism. Here was a big movement, an extensive movement, which went into all kinds of literature from an extremely skeptical viewpoint, a strange combination of skepticism and credibility. Skepticism as to the dependability of records of ancient times, and extreme credibility as to the ability of modern thinkers to reconstruct what may have happened in ancient times. That is the very great weakness of this whole higher critical approach, to assume that practically every ancient book or medieval book came into existence by a number of books being put together, and with a little of this, a little of that, a little of the other, and so on, in a rather clumsy way. There have been books written that way, but they're not usually very good books. But to assume that this has been done in so many cases is a pretty big assumption. But it was accepted as almost a certainty by most literary scholars in relation to most literary studies up until within the last few decades. But today, it has, except in relation to the Bible and Homer, it has just about completely disappeared. Now, I shouldn't say only in relation to them. There is still, I believe, a scholar in Europe who is still writing, doing the same thing with Shakespeare. He says we are able to peek into Shakespeare's workshop and see exactly how he constructed his plays. And what he says 30 years ago would have been regarded with great esteem, but today most of the other Shakespearean scholars think it rather ridiculous. But there is still one who is doing that, and there are a very few scholars who are using this method in relation to Pierce Plowman or other medieval or ancient works. But it has been pretty thoroughly given up. The assumption that these works, that all works practically, were put together this way is a tremendous big assumption. But then an even greater assumption is the assumption that we are able to reconstruct them, that we are able to do it. I would just like to have some people today take one of our presidential addresses, take a great address by any one of our presidents in the last 3 or 4 years, and then give him the names of the men who helped in writing it, and let him see their work, and then let him get busy, and simply from their other writings and the presidential address, let him tell us which phrases and which sentences were put in by each of these different writers and what was done by the president himself in his final revision. And I would be amazed if he got in more than one case out of four if he detected exactly what the origin is. There are cases, particular instances where it's easy, particular phrases, you recognize the style and so on. But to do it to anything like the extent that the higher critics claim to be able to do it is simply unthinkable, and it has been given up by practically all literary scholars today. But until within the last few decades, it was accepted literary procedure. And so it was actively applied to the Bible. And then we noticed, number two, early Hegelian interpretation. And this Hegelian interpretation has great similarity in general principle to the idea of evolution, because it is the idea that there is a constant change under a succession of forces. And there were a few who tried to reinterpret the Bible from this viewpoint, but actually not much was done with this viewpoint in the early part of the 19th century. But number three, we mentioned the union of these two forces in the Gross-Bellhausen theory. And the union of these two forces produced a theory which was utterly unlike what the higher critics had maintained about the Old Testament prior to this union. That is, most of the higher critics. Now, of course, the higher critics before that time had a tremendous variety of theories. the very great variety of theories, but certain of them had been most widely accepted. And these which had been most widely accepted before did not fit with the evolutionary approach. But it was Grupp who combined the two by taking the theory of development from the simple to the complex, from the very primitive to the more advanced, and applying it, and in order to do so, he had to take that part of the Pentateuch which most higher critics before his time had said was the last written and make it the first written. Some people call it a Copernican revolution in the approach. That for 50 years, the majority of the higher critics had held that the so-called P document, that is the priestly law, the regulation for the temple, and the genealogy, and all that sort of thing, were the foundation, the original thing of the Pentateuch, and then the other parts had been added to them. Now they said the other parts were the original, and these laws had been added later in the genealogies in the first chapter of Genesis in order to show a development from simple to complex. It was a complete turnaround in the order of the documents. And so when Grupp first presented it, it was not very much accepted. But a brilliant Dutch scholar, Abraham Kuenen, K-U-E-N-E-N, Abraham Kuenen, professor at the University of Leiden, took Grupp's theory, made certain adjustments in it that made it somewhat more reasonable, and made it fit together somewhat better, and advanced it. And it's sometimes called the Grupp-Kuenen-Wellhausen theory. Actually, perhaps the Kuenen theory would be the most proper name for it, because Kuenen actually, with the changes that he made in Grupp's suggestions, put it in practically the form in which it came to be accepted. But only a few scholars were reading Grupp's work, and only a few scholars were reading Kuenen's work at that time. And then Professor Julius Wellhausen, professor at the University of Greifswald in northern Germany, Professor Julius Wellhausen, W-E-L-L-H-A-U-S-E-N, a very brilliant scholar, had a special gift which was and probably still is comparatively rare among German scholars. And that was the ability to write a good sentence in which you'd only have to look down two or three lines to find the verb instead of sometimes two or three pages, as they say. That is to say, he made a much simpler general style. And while the German language as used by most scholars is a wonderful instrument for the presentation of exact thoughts, it is a rather cumbersome instrument for those who do not wish to pay very close attention and to hold the thought of the long sentences and the long participial phrase in mind till they get to the end of it. Well, Wellhausen had a German style that was much easier for the average educated person to grasp quicker than that of most scholars in the field of higher criticism. And he had a brilliant mind. He had a great influence on his students, and his books began to have a great influence outside in general. And it was, I believe, in 1878, when he wrote his great book on the history of Israel, later reissued, slightly revised, under the title of Prolegomenon to the History of Israel. But this book was not the first presentation by any means. In his classes, he had been influencing great numbers of students. But this carried the scholarly world by storm, because it combined the evolutionary idea with the higher criticism in a way that looks so reasonable that if you believe in a world in which there is not a supernatural agency overseeing and directing, but in which all things happen according to natural processes, it seems to give a very reasonable explanation of a natural process whereby the books of Moses would have come into existence. It was thus similar in the theological field to what Darwin did. Darwin gave the evolutionary idea was already widely held among those who were moving away from Christianity, but Darwin presented what seemed like a simple explanation of how evolution would have worked. And it seemed so simple and so clear that many people said, why didn't I have sense enough to think of that? And they felt that Darwin had simply given the answer and shown that you didn't need, as Haeckel of Germany said, you have completely done away with any need of theory whatever in considering the world when you see the explanation that Darwin has given. And Wellhausen seems to have done the same thing for the Pentateuch. And so the older scholars, many of them still clung to the older, higher critical idea. But the younger scholars, just as the younger scholars followed Darwinism in the scientific field, the younger scholars followed the Wellhausen theory, and it had a tremendous vogue in Germany and in other countries. Well, this is number three. Number four, we will call application of Hegelian and divisive theory to other books of Old and New Testament. Application of Hegelian and divisive theories to other books of the Old and New Testament. The spread of these theories did not begin with Wellhausen's book and with the wide acceptance of the Wellhausen theory. They began with the teaching of these various scholars in their classes and the influence that their graduates had. They seemed to be very widely extended when these books were published. But it was therefore not after Wellhausen's book came out, but after the influence of these theories had begun to be widely extended, that similar theories were applied to other books of the first of the Old Testament. Now, of course, the first of these on which a great impression was made was the book of Isaiah, because there it was easy to present a very simple theory. So simple that, like Darwinism, at first sight it seemed almost inevitable to accept the idea that you take your first 39 books of Isaiah and you have several mentions of Isaiah in them. The last 27, you have no mention of Isaiah at all. In the first 39, you have many mentions of the king of Assyria. He's never mentioned after chapter 39. In the first 39 chapters, you have many references to the kings of Israel and threat of that God will send the people into exile. You do not have that sort of thing after 39. But after 39, you have an assumption that the people are already in exile. And you have these people in exile assured that God is going to deliver them. And you have thus a different feeling of background in the last part of Isaiah than the first part. And so it's very natural to suggest that the first part was written when the Assyrian kings were threatening the land with conquest, but God delivered it. And then that there was a statement given at the end of 39 that they would be taken captive to the land of Babylon, not to Assyria. And then the fifth having been written, with this lucky guess at the end of 39, that it would be Babylon rather than Assyria to which they would be taken, that 150 years later, after they had been taken to Babylon, an unknown prophet, writing in the spirit of Isaiah and thoroughly imbued with the terminology and approach of Isaiah, would have written 27 wonderful chapters to encourage the people and promise them that God was going to deliver them from exile, and that these got copied onto the same scroll, being so similar in general approach, copied on the same scroll. So you had the 39 chapters of the first Isaiah, and then you had these 27 chapters by an unknown writer added on the same scroll, and eventually it was easy for the whole thing to be called the book of Isaiah. A very simple theory. And this theory was advanced long before the Wellhausen theory was widely accepted. And so this extension to the book of Isaiah, if you read Time Magazine 2 weeks ago, you saw that it's now been proven true by computers. But unfortunately for the computers, Nobody continued, or no scholars continued very long to hold this theory after it was first presented 150 years ago or so, 138, because they very soon found that the particular evidences they found in the last part of Isaiah to suggest it was written later were found in many parts of the first 39 chapters. And so the two Isaiah idea was held by very few scholars for any length of time. And very soon, both the first part and the last part were being divided up into many little sections written by many different writers. And that is the way in which most of the critics hold it today. They say the question is not, did Isaiah write this or that? We know that Isaiah wrote comparatively little. The question is, at what period was this written? And so they'll tell you that one particular chapter was written a certain year, and a few verses in the next were written 300 years later, and then a few more verses 100 years earlier, and so on. And the ability to tell when things were written like this is simply superhuman. Nobody today feels that we can do that. That is very easy today. But this was done with Isaiah and extended to other books, except for a long time they didn't do it to Ezekiel. Because Ezekiel was the fulcrum upon which the Pentateuch was much of it shown to be earlier and much later. Ezekiel was the fixed point for a long time. And then after the other was thoroughly accepted, then they divided Ezekiel up also. But it was left until comparatively late in the process. Now, there were scholars who advanced these theories regarding the Old Testament, who gained a great deal of their strength in so doing by their strong, pious statements about the New Testament and their insistence on great New Testament doctrines, even while dividing up the Old Testament this way. And it was much harder to attack these scholars because of their great statements about the integrity of the New Testament and the dependability of its doctrine. But at the same time, similar approaches were being taken towards the New Testament. We find, for instance, David Friedrich Strauss, S-T-R-A-U-S-S. David Friedrich Strauss, who lived from 1880 to 1874, had already taken a very critical attitude towards the New Testament. And in his Life of Jesus in 1835, denied the historical validity of many of the gospel narratives. And this Life of Christ by Strauss was translated into English by George Eliot, whom we have already referred to as a typical representative of the late Victorian attitude of giving up biblical belief, but holding strongly to the ethics and the idea of duty and decency and so on, incorporated, which was a result of the Victorian ethics. Last night I came across an interesting illustration of the effects of the evangelical movement which had brought it into England. It was in connection with Charles Darwin. Darwin expressed great surprise and curiosity at the great change that had come in English attitudes between the time of his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, and his own time. Because in Darwin's time, what they speak of as Victorianism, which was simply the result of the evangelical movement spreading out through society with its concepts of ethics and of decency, was dominant in the attitudes of English people as a whole, even though they were turning away from Christianity. While before the great evangelical movement had spread out into society in general, England was still, to quite an extent, under the effects of the great decline of ethics under Charles II and James II and their successors. And Charles Darwin remarked that his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, had had at least two illegitimate children whom he had recognized. That is, whom he had recognized as being his children, and nobody knew how many more he might have had, but nobody thought any of the worst of his grandfather Erasmus for this. But in Charles Darwin's day, for a man,
to be have been the father of an illegitimate child would immediately give him a tremendous social stigma in England. And this, of course, was the result of the evangelical revival. Now these people were holding these standards of duty and of truth and of decency, which were the result of it, but trying to kick out from under them the ladder on which they had risen in the direction. And so George Eliot was strongly opposed to supernatural Christianity, though greatly devoted to ideas of duty and of decency. Well, now, another one in this connection, transferring these ideas to the New Testament, was Ferdinand Christian Bauer, B-A-U-R. Bauer, who lived from 1792 to 1860, was the founder of what was called the Tübingen School of Theology. And he applied these theories of development to the New Testament and believed that the struggle between the views of Paul and the views of Peter had been the two different side factors from which the synthesis was made in the writings of John and the development of the New Testament. And so most of the New Testament books were written in the second century. And thus, these approaches, which were taken in the Old Testament, were extended to the New and are to this day in most teaching. There are groups of scholars in this general area that get together to try to study the Q document and try to decide exactly what parts are originally parts of the Q document and which parts come from other sources in the gospel as they apply these theories, which are still the application to the Bible of a literary approach which is no longer used in other literature, that is practically no longer used. But now I want to look at the extension of this over in the British Isles. And so we mention number five, William Robertson Smith and the Free Church of Scotland. William Robertson Smith and the Free Church of Scotland. We have noticed how the Free Church of Scotland came into existence. We saw the great struggle that they had to get places where they could have meetings for their churches, and the difficulty of continuing when there was all the efforts of the landlords to compel them to remain in the established church and subject to their control. But we saw how they succeeded, and there were the two, there was Horatius Bonar and Andrew Bonar, and these other great Christian leaders, Chalmers, of course, in the first two or three years of it before his death, these other great Christian leaders who built this great church in Scotland. But while they were building this great church, they gave their energy to the extension of the gospel throughout the world and carried on, built up a tremendous missionary work to the extension of the gospel to all classes of civilization of people in Scotland, to the attempt to make sure that everyone in their churches had truly received Christ as Savior. They put tremendous stress on all these various aspects of practical work, but neglected to give as much effort, at least as over the course of the years, as now looking back we can see was desirable, to maintaining the absolute integrity of the teaching in their theological seminary. They had to establish, of course, new colleges and a new seminary, the so-called New College, they called their seminary in Edinburgh. And in the New College, there was a professor of Old Testament they called Rabbi Duncan, who was, because he was an Old Testament, they called him Rabbi. But Duncan was a great linguist, tremendous knowledge, a great speaker, but many thought that his ideas were not organized as well as he might wish. He was a great Christian leader, more than so much an Old Testament scholar. So he had a tremendous knowledge of language and a tremendous wide knowledge of various types. But a young man, a brilliant young man named A.B. Davidson, became assistant to Duncan. and when Duncan died, took over his position. And Davidson had studied in Germany under some of these higher critics, and Davidson began very quietly, but very skillfully, to present some of their ideas. He is not as great a linguist, has not as great an understanding, knowledge as Duncan, but he was better organized in his presentation, better organized, more systematic. He had a greater influence on the thought processes of his students. And A.B. Davidson never came under great attack. He was very tactful, very careful in his presentation. But the Old Testament higher critical ideas, the basis of it, began to come into his class. And then into one of his classes came a brilliant young man named William Robertson Smith, son of a Free Church pastor. William Robertson Smith was born in 1846. He was brought up in this Free Church man, had a brilliant mind, brilliant in sciences and in mathematics, and he was able to see what Davidson was driving at, and was tremendously impressed with Davidson's ideas. And then he went to Germany and studied. And studying in Germany there, he became a close friend of Wellhausen and of other leaders in Germany of the higher critical thought. And Robertson, when he was only 24 years of age, he was made professor of Old Testament at the Aberdeen College. In Aberdeen in Scotland, and there he had a very attractive personality, a brilliant mind, and had a great influence on his students. And if he had confined himself to influence on his students, he might have continued at Aberdeen for the next 50 years. But he was an able writer, and he became friends with the man who was editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which was then coming out, eighth edition in eighth or ninth, I forget which, in a volume at a time. And they asked him to write the volume on Bible. And he wrote the article on Bible, a long article in which he showed how the Bible was the result of a long evolution of combining different sections and different ideas developing according to a natural evolutionary process. And of course, that was in line in 1876. Darwinism was coming into the ascendancy now, and it was right in line with many widely held popular attitudes. But you remember Andrew Bonar and Horatius Bonar, who'd been so active in the founding of the Free Church. They were now somewhat older, but still very prominent in the church. They brought charges before the General Assembly against Smith for having written this way about the Bible. They said it strikes at the very foundation of our religion. And the General Assembly appointed a committee to investigate, but the other professors, some of them, came strongly to his defense. And the discussion continued for 5 years, till 1881. In 1880, he was given an invitation to become professor in Harvard University. And he thought it might be an easy way out of his difficulties over there to simply move over here. But he did not do so. But in 1880, he published a whole book on the Old Testament in the Jewish Church, in which his ideas of the ideas of his good friend Wellhausen were presented in very attractive English style, and the book was received by the Darwinians with great praise, and the what he considered the old mossbacks in the church were greatly shocked at it, and the leaders in the colleges tried to work a compromise, and the result of all this was that they did not convict him of heresy or remove him from the church, but they voted to drop him from his professorship at Aberdeen. And George Adam Smith, a man 10 years younger than he was, now took over, was asked to take over the teaching of his classes. I have downstairs a book written by George Adam Smith after his death by his wife, telling about his life. And in it, he tells how when George Adam Smith, who was in his 20s, took over the classes of William Robinson Smith, who was in his 30s, that he went to see William Robinson Smith and asked him for suggestions on handling the class. And he said that Robertson Smith looked at him. He said, Robertson Smith was a little fellow, and he said he was filled with emotion and upset about what had happened. And he was very hostile toward him. And George Adam Smith, as he asked him, he said he saw his very hostile attitude. And he said, well, I wish you could give me some suggestions. How would you think I could best handle these classics? And William Robertson Smith said, suppose I don't pay any attention to the rule of the General Assembly. Suppose I just go ahead and teach. What would you do then? Well, he says, I would attend the class and learn all I could from you. And that completely changed Robertson Smith's attitude towards him. So they removed Robertson Smith from the position, but the man who succeeded him was one who was a great admirer of Robertson Smith and perhaps was a bit more tactful in presenting the ideas. And that's the sort of thing that we see repeated over and over. It is not in the end, what determines our churches in the end is, of course, the ministers in the pulpits and the people in the positions of authority. But the attitudes of these people had usually been determined years before in their training, in their schools. And in all of our organizations, the tendency has been to put an undue stress on what we call academic freedom. If a man looks good when he starts, leave him free no matter what direction he may go. And it is the source from which unbelief has come in and has wrecked most of our institutions in the last 100 years. But at any rate, Robertson Smith then devoted his whole time for 2 years to helping in editing the Encyclopedia Britannica. In a few months, the editor-in-chief died and he took over. So he was editor-in-chief and his influence was very great through that. And then after 2 years, he was called to Cambridge University, where he became professor of Arabic and exerted a great influence throughout the English-speaking world. And the Free Church of Scotland, which had had such a wonderful start and had stood so nobly against the so self-sacrificingly in its determination to present the true gospel, was now becoming shot through with these men who had adopted the higher critical view. Number six in this connection, the destruction of Andover Seminary. That we noticed the foundation of Andover Seminary. We noticed what a tremendous influence it was in New England Congregationalism. We noticed how hundreds of missionaries from Andover Seminary in the last century went to regions all over the world, and hundreds of thousands of people were won to the Lord through the graduates of Andover Seminary. But now the higher criticism began to come into Andover Seminary, and this seminary, which had had several hundred students in it and scholars whose books were recognized all over the world, this seminary eventually fell under the control of the modernists, and then its attendance fell off until finally they closed the seminary because there weren't enough students to make it worthwhile and turned over its endowment to Harvard University. And 20 years ago, the Theological Seminary of Harvard University, which represented both the old Harvard Divinity School and the Andover combined with it, had less than 20 undergraduates about 20 years ago. Now, in recent years, efforts have been made to build it up and to increase it and to get a larger number of students to it. But that was the condition of the undergraduate Harvard Seminary, well, at least 30 years ago, I think 20 years ago. So much for number six. On number seven, Union Seminary and the Briggs Trial. In New York, Union Theological Seminary was in close touch with the developments in Germany and in France and in Great Britain, And the higher criticism of the Old Testament was strongly presented in its classics. And Professor Charles Augustus Briggs of the seminary became a very strong supporter of the Bellhausen theory, wrote a series of books presenting it, which had considerable influence. I was interested just yesterday to get this book, General Introduction to the Study of the Holy Scripture by Charles Augustus Briggs, published by Baker's in Grand Rapids, introduction by Charles F. Pfeiffer. And this is the book which was published at about 1899 by Charles Augustus Briggs, and now reprinted today by the Baker Book Company. And Pfeiffer, in his introduction, says you don't have to agree with everything that Briggs says to see the tremendous value in much of what he says. But it is a terrible indictment of present-day evangelical scholarship that a bookstore, a book publishing company, which aims to reach the evangelical public with its book, and which aims to publish mainly evangelical material, should think it necessary, in order to publish a scholarly book on the Bible, to publish a book 70 years old, reprint. Now, it is true that Briggs mastered a tremendous amount of material. But, and it is true also that as you read the book, you have many pious expressions about the New Testament and about Christ and the importance of the Savior and the importance of the Holy Scriptures and so on. But you have a very strong presentation of the Wellhausen theory and of the attitude toward the Old Testament, which led on to taking the same attitude toward the New Testament, and then led on to the situation in Union Seminary today, where any belief in a truly supernatural God would be, I fear, a rather rare thing among either students or faculty. But Briggs was, for his writings in the higher criticism, he was tried by the General Assembly, first by the Presbytery of New York, in which the Union Seminary graduates were very prominent, and so they're acquitted, but carried to the General Assembly. Professor William Henry Green of Princeton Seminary was his great antagonist in this, and eventually he left the Presbyterian Church, went into the Episcopal Church, and Union Seminary left the denomination on account of it was 1892, his trial was held, and they left the denomination and, of course, have gone far in the direction in which they were rapidly moving then. Now, the Wellhausen theory did not bring about these things. The movement was already strongly in existence before, just as Darwin's theory did not bring about evolution. But it crystallized it, and it gave a tremendous push forward to it, and its influence has reached out in most of the different denominational movements. So much for number seven. Now, number eight, attempts to hold to Christianity without the Bible. Briggs would defend the deity of Christ, his virgin birth, and various New Testament doctrines, but in his own field of the Old Testament, he would teach the view which, carried on logically, would destroy the whole of biblical teaching. The same was true of Professor Driver in England, a brilliant man in England, whose books have been reprinted recently also, though not by evangelical publishers. But Driver introduced the Wellhausen theory to quite an extent into England with his brilliant Introduction to the Old Testament, very excellently written and presented, and adopting what was the standard higher critical view of that day. There was an English bishop named Gore, G-O-R-E, who wrote a great many books which had very wide influence, trying to say we can hold the deity of Christ, we can hold the virgin birth, we can hold all these great vital doctrines, even if they prove the Bible is only the product of an evolutionary development, something that has come into existence through a long process.
and so on. Actually, of course, it has not worked out that way, and it cannot work out that way. But this is a halfway state, which makes it easy for people to shift over. If you once adopt the higher criticism regarding the Old Testament, inevitably, logically, you must do the same thing regarding the New Testament. And so this halfway state we constantly find now as the new Christian school, other Christian schools, other denominations that have held true for a time are entered by the higher criticism. That people who advance it make very strong statements of their loyalty to Christ and their great stand on New Testament doctrine, and insist that loyalty to truth compels the acceptance of this regarding the Old Testament, and then it isn't very long before it is carried over to the New Testament and to all of the great doctrines of Christianity. But we see this movement which has entered so many different groups in these last 100 years and been so tremendously effective. Then in number nine, the so-called old-fashioned liberalism. The so-called old-fashioned liberalism, that is, 10 or 50 years ago, they called it the old-fashioned liberalism because it then seemed to be pretty much out of date. But it was the movement which largely took over in Germany early in the century, of whom perhaps the outstanding representative is Professor von Harnack in the University of Berlin. Professor von Harnack, H-A-R-N-A-C-K, Professor von Harnack, a brilliant scholar, close friend of the emperor, who used to come to class, they say, in full dress at 7 o'clock in the morning and lecture for an hour in order to be properly dressed to go and see the emperor at 8:30. And he wrote on What is Christianity? And his book on What is Christianity, he told me personally that at one time when his book had been published, they had to turn over a whole warehouse. A whole great railroad warehouse was devoted simply to the packages containing the copies of his book that were being distributed all over on What is Christianity. It is translated to many languages. He told me he had just heard it been translated now into Icelandic. And he presented a Christianity which believed in a very wonderful man, Jesus, who was not a God. He was a man, but he had some beautiful ideas, and he set a wonderful example. And if you have the spirit of Jesus, you have what is really vital in Christianity, according to von Harnack and his associates. But along with that, von Harnack did some very excellent historical research, and he destroyed the foundations of some of the critical ideas with some of his excellent researches showing that they were without true foundation, showing the historicity of many things in the scripture. He was a very great scholar, but he represented this somewhat like Gore, only more advanced, getting away from supernatural Christianity almost entirely. I heard the last series of public lectures that he gave in 1927 in Berlin. Well, this was the move, this so-called old-fashioned liberalism, which took over so much of Christian churches during the early part of this century. It seemed until 1914 as if the beautiful ethics of Jesus, forget about the supernatural, forget about the biblical statements, forget about whether these things are accurate or dependable. We have the wonderful character of Jesus. We should follow his example. We have his wonderful ethics. I read he called him the days of his flesh by an Englishman, named Smith, I believe. I had to read when I was in seminary, and he tells about the Gospel of John and how unhistorical it is, and you cannot trust any of the statements about when things happened or their order, or any of the historical statements. But he said, when you read the sayings of Jesus in it, your heart burns within you, and you know these are genuine, even though all the rest of it is undependable. Well, these people have a strong emotion from a Christian background, try to hold to certain aspects of Christianity, and their influence is tremendous in advancing the destructive idea, which then destroys that which they think is important. When I was a young fellow, there were many people who spoke as if a man really loves the Lord, he's got to be a foreign missionary. There's no other way to really love the Lord than to be a foreign missionary. Well, of course, it is a very great work, and we certainly want to do everything we can to advance it. But the Lord calls some to one faith and some to another faith. But then the attitude was taken, if you're not a good enough Christian to be a foreign missionary, then you might be an evangelist in this country. And if you're not quite a good enough Christian to be an evangelist in this country, then you might be a pastor. But if you don't have any faith, then you can teach the next generation in the college of the country. And now we are reaping the fruit of that sort of an attitude, which unfortunately has given us a generation of intellectual leaders who have turned away from the truth almost entirely. Now we turn to capital F, the Roman Catholic Church in the 19th century. The Roman Catholic Church in the 19th century. At the beginning of the century, the church was not in a very strong situation. They had not had any great start in the United States, and in France, the French Revolution had caused many of the priests to become atheists and many others to flee to other countries, and for a time they even did away with the Christian week and had a 10-day week under the French Revolution. And in the beginning of the century, the Roman Catholic Church seemed to be in quite a weak position. But it strengthened greatly in the next few years. In 1814, the Jesuits were reestablished, and they were the strong military force of the Roman Church. And they were very skillful, very able in building colleges and schools and in securing control of various aspects of the church, not for whoever happened to be pope, but for the organization as they understood it should be. And there was a bishop in Maryland in America, Bishop Harrell, P-A-R-R-O-L, who had great influence in extending the church and building it up. And their center was mostly, they were just in Maryland in 1800. But they began to spread to other parts of the country, and of course immigration began to bring many more into the country. And by 1846, the church was on a much stronger foundation than it had been in 1800. Napoleon had made a concordat with the Pope, by which he had arranged that they were given a great many privileges again in France, and they became reestablished to a very large extent in France. In 1846, Pius IX became Pope. And Pius IX was Pope from 1846 to 1878. And in 32 years, he had time to plan and to move forward and to exert a great influence in many ways. And he greatly strengthened the monarchical situation of the church. Thus, in 1849, he began to send out letters suggesting, asking advice of various bishops whether it would be a good thing to proclaim the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary. This had been held by many Romanists before, but had not been an official doctrine. And now he asked whether this would be a good time to proclaim it as an official doctrine. And so in 1854, after 5 years of consideration, he made an official proclamation that the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary was an official doctrine of the Roman Church, and he declared this as the
infallible teacher. And the way it was received without much difficulty made it easy for him to proceed towards the acceptance of the idea of papal infallibility. But he moved slowly and carefully in that direction. It wasn't until 1870 that that was proclaimed. First, in 1864, he issued a syllabus of errors, in which he said that such things as Bible societies, belief in separation of church and state, he named almost all of these modern tendencies, he said were errors and completely wrong. They like to forget today the syllabus of errors, but it had quite an influence in its day. But we'll have to stop for now and continue there tomorrow morning.